So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
All right, now that I have my tea, this is Geekfully Yoked, the world's first best married Christian geek podcast. A podcast about faith, family, and fandom in no particular order. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto, and I'm a major nerd.
And I let med students practice doing their medical technology things on me, and I'm a huge geek. So Rachel, what is today all about?
Today is all about tomorrow.
Is that a quote? Is that a thing?
I don't know.
There's no day but today. I know that.
I thought that was
Is that a song from Newsies? You have to sit and think if that is a song from Newsies. That is not a good sign. Nothing should be a song from Newsies or potentially be a song from Newsies.
I thought you were trying to segue into how tomorrow is about the new Louis Master Bujold book and not, in fact, about the American election at all.
Oh, that's right. So we are going to be touching base on our topic already.
What were you talking about today?
I was just asking how your day was. That's all I had. You're the one who started possibly quoting Newsies. Anyway, we've already jumped ahead, but we will be discussing Lois and Master Bujold and her amazing book series, The Borkosigan Saga, which, if you are not reading it, you are probably not very good friends with us because we would have yelled at you about reading it.
So what have you been up to this week, Lehman?
I've been playing a lot of video games. I got Fallout 3 because it was on sale for... Not Fallout 3. I got Fallout New Vegas because it was on sale for Halloween, and it's been awesome. And I now run around in a spacesuit hitting people with a sword made out of a car bumper. Although I must say, this was a pretty lackluster Halloween. For one very specific reason.
Okay, dear internet, is it not absurd that my husband whinges at me every year about going to the Halloween party at the department that I graduated from 4 years ago?
All right. First off, I don't whinge every year because normally I get to go. This year I was not allowed to go, and that is why I'm whinging. And I would like to point out that I am always invited to this party.
It's so creepy and weird.
I am invited to this party by my friends who still attend there.
Creepy and weird.
I missed seeing people dressed up as Imperial Stormtroopers this year, Rachel.
The Medieval Studies Department at U of T does do a magnificent Halloween party, it has to be said.
They're so awesome!
I've been reading Blog to Books. This was a major Blog to Book week.
This was a major... I bought you lots of things from my bookstore week.
You did.
We just sort of... Stuff just kept coming out. Would you like to go through your hoard?
Well, first off, Smitten Kitchen, which is my favorite food blog, had its cookbook come out, which has been long awaited. And that was very exciting. And it even did the unthinkable, which was inspire you to cook dinner, which was quite sweet of you.
I did try to cook dinner, although I think the meal that came out of it probably could have been better, mostly in that it could not have been made by me.
But it was very sweet, and it was very tasty and comforting on a brisk autumnal evening. Then we had Rachel Held Evans' much anticipated year of biblical womanhood.
Which our dog promptly ate.
Yes, Bilbo did eat it. It's true. Probably just out of his disgust that he was not able to eat the small stuffed Bilbo Baggins that you also brought me.
That's right. We now have a little Martin Freeman action figure, which is very cute.
And which
sort of
Bilbo
creepy.
Wants to eat more than anything in the entire world.
Our dog went crazy over this thing.
And then you brought me a cup, which has, you can't get a cup of tea big enough or a book long enough to suit me, quoted by C.S. Lewis, which I am now using to drink my chocolatey chai tea, which you hate.
And that was our Geek Week, so let's move on to our main feature, which we've sort of alluded at bits and pieces. Today, we're going to be looking at religion, surprise, surprise, but we're going to be looking at religion from two of our favorite fantasy sci-fi authors. And that would be George R.R. Martin.
And Lewis from Master Bujold.
I've often said that these two people seem very, very similar. Lois and Master Bujold I've sort of always described as George R. R. Martin with an editor.
She is much tighter.
But they do very similar things. If you don't know George R. R. Martin, I'm
assuming you don't live on the planet at the moment.
George R. R. Martin, of course, being famous author of the Song of Ice and Fire series, also known as Game of Thrones, the television series.
our household, though, we like to think of him as the man who gave us the live-action Beauty and the Beast TV show, which we still have the first season of on DVD. I think we only got through the first two discs.
It's very 90s. There's a lot of shoulder pads and peach.
There's a lot of peach. And Linda Hamilton doing what she does best, which is sort of look put out.
Yeah.
And then Lois McMaster Bujold is an amazing author. She's written a couple of different series and some standalone books. The big series is the Vorkosigan Saga, which the newest book will be coming out tomorrow.
Tomorrow as we record this.
We're being Tuesday. And this is Captain Vorpetril's
Alliance,
which we're both looking very much forward to. But she's also written the Sharing Knife series. And the Curse of Chalion series, does it have a name outside of that? Anyway.
It seems to be just the Chalion series.
Chalion series.
Trilogy.
Also very good. But both of them, what we love in both of them, I think, is their ability to create a world, their ability to populate it with very interesting characters that seem to have, like, actual depth to them.
And what Lois Masters Bujold has, in my opinion, over George R. R. Martin, aside from an editor, is a sense of humor and actually fully realized female characters.
Yeah.
Not George R. R. Martin's strong suit, let's be honest.
Sometimes, well, he lets his women kill lots of people.
Yes, but they're still kind of one note. I don't know.
Some notes are very stabby.
Well, okay, stabby does not make a fully realized person.
I'm just saying.
Don't make me talk about Aaron's son, because I could.
I don't want to make you talk about Aaron's son. Yes, it is very true. I do think that Bujold, being a woman, is able to write from a female perspective with a touch more nuance than George R. R. Martin does. Though I think George R. R. Martin has descriptions of food down pat.
I feel like somewhere inside, a feminist screamed when she heard you sort of put women and food on the same level. Things that exist for our consumption and enjoyment. I'm just laying that out there. Because if I don't, Giselle will scream at you when she hears this podcast.
Giselle will be fine. But both authors do a remarkable job, along with creating worlds and characters, is looking at religion.
That's what we really want to talk about here. Because there's a lot that could be said to compare these two. But it's really their use of religion and their understanding of the place of the religious impulse in human society, which I think they both do more effectively than a lot of authors.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, neither of them are overtly religious. And to my knowledge, neither of them are particularly vocal in you know, describing their faith or discussing their faith. So you don't get that kind of, you know, either C.S. Lewis or even sort of Tolkien-esque kind of religiosity creeping in, or, you know, those masters of subtlety, LaHaye and Jenkins, that we mentioned in our last discussion.
I'm giving you a look.
Which translates beautifully in podcasting terms. If we could just sort of make that an audible sigh, I think the folks will understand much better. But no, I mean, their worlds are religious, but it neither feels sort of shoved down your throat, nor does it feel tacked on. In a lot of sort of fantasy, they will have a church, a religion that sort of...
But these are really well thought out religious systems.
Yeah.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Mr. Martin?
Let's start with Ms. Martin, which is probably the most famous. In the Game of Thrones books...
In Westeros.
We see all sorts of different religions. I mean, the main religion that we see over and over again is this religion of the Seven.
Yeah.
Which has parallels to both kind of pantheistic religions, but also ties into these faiths where you have kind of one god made up of multiple parts, whether it's sort of the triune god of Christianity or even some of the sort of traditional African, you know, Western African religions where you do have these sort of many, many gods, but they all kind of make up a single god.
Deity, a single godhead.
Precisely. And we have that, and it's very well established, and it's understood, though, that it's the religion that's been brought to these lands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have also...
There is a foreign aspect to it.
Yeah. You know, they always speak about the Andals came and they brought their gods with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of the two main gods that we see, or sort of main forces that we see prior to this, would be the sort of the old gods
of the north,
and then the sort of the drowned gods of the Kraken,
yes,
and of the sort of the Great,
which are both. I mean, they're harsher realities.
Well,
I mean,
they're very chthonic, right?
Yeah. They're sort of formless. There's
yeah, and you know, you get the sense of I mean, I don't know if it's really based on like druidism or kind of just sort of generic paganism, but again, it's they're dealt with very seriously. You know, people take their faith seriously and live by these certain codes and by what's expected of them. And you definitely get this sense, not that it's not Dungeons and Dragons, right? In Dungeons and Dragons, which a lot of fantasy can sort of, you know, wind up aping, you know, the gods are very laid out. They're mechanical. You know, you can technically go and visit them in their higher planes, and you know what their strength score is.
Whereas the old gods, I mean, I'm going to leave aside the drowned god for a second, but the old god, Ned Stark's gods.
Mm-hmm. They're tied to the
earth. They're
present.
Yeah. But they're present, and they're real, and they're tangible in a way, but they're also... They're not predictable. They're not a mechanistic system. They're
yeah,
not.
And Martin has definitely made it very clear that there is a sort of active spiritual reality that affects this world. People have dreams. Those dreams come true. People interact with sort of prophetic things, and those things, you know, have meaning. You know, he's not depicting a superstitious people, you know, who just believe in something.
Well, and I think that what's very interesting is the way the religion and the society feed off of each other.
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
I mean, I guess there's almost a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing, whether it's the cold, harsh north that created this religion around these harsher
people and
gods.
Environments. Oh,
yeah.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Or if it's, you know, this religion that creates a people that value honor and strength and integrity and...
Yeah, but in the North, you also have this sense of story and this sense of storytelling, and they're very connected to the past, and they're always sort of referring to things that have come before them. And Westeros has that kind of fantasy thing of like of several thousand years worth of history where technology hasn't progressed that much, which makes you a little worried. It's like, oh, come on, guys. You know, at least, you know, get like some, like an ox cart going or something. But yeah, you do have this sense of a long, angry, bloody time, a time of survival and a time of need and persistent sort of deprivation, which has its impact on both presumably the cultural faith and how the people deal with it. Whereas the religion of the Seven definitely feels more sort of medievally Catholic, you know?
Yeah. No, very much so. And there's an institution built around it. There's that fits a society that's somewhat more developed and structured.
And they provide history within it. I mean, you see, you know, and they describe, you know, sort of Baylor the Blessed, and they describe these kind of, you know, different kings and how they relate and how the church changes. Mm-hmm. And in some of the later books, in Feast for Crows, you see how the church is beginning to change in a new direction and how that is...
Absolutely.
And it's
the
brilliant.
The power that the church is assuming. I mean, that one of the things that I think you and I have always really liked about George R. R. Martin is the way he plays with the feudal system, the way he plays with the complexities of the great houses with the lesser houses and the conflicting loyalties that come from that.
Yeah. And the church
starts playing, using the word church. I don't mean to use the word church. Yeah.
The septas?
The seven. Yes, the septs come into that as well when you begin to start seeing the role of the church in this society and the role of the high septon. Is the high septon in the small council?
Not at this point, I don't think.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell. The small council kind of bounces around a bit.
Yes.
But
you see the power that they start to assume and amass, and that plays with the integrity of the religion, right?
It does. And I think for folks watching the show right now, what really seems very stark in difference, in contrast, is the new religion of R'hllor.
Yes.
And the Lord of Light, and this kind of, you know, burning the old ways and, you know, superseding this, you know, religion. And it's very much being more alien and strange and having these sort of fiery converts. And, you know, I'm sure much can be said about the depiction of a monotheism that comes in demanding fire and sacrifice and blood.
And uncompromising allegiance.
Yeah. At all costs.
But the thing that's disturbing is it might be right. I mean, that's what,
yeah,
what is fascinating, mm-hmm, is that it might be true.
That's very true. Although I find, I found the chapters in the newest book from Melisandre's point of view. I don't know. There's something kind of disappointing about them.
Want to know why? Do you want to know why?
Yes, I want to know why.
Because George R. R. Martin can't write women.
But the Cersei chapters were good. Like, reveal was interesting.
That's because he was writing the downfall of a woman. He cannot write a good, strong, interesting woman. What makes Cersei an interesting character is that she thinks that she's a good, strong, powerful woman. And the great reveal of Feast for Crows is that she's not, and she's self-delusional.
That's very true. There's Brienne.
I hate Brienne!
The Arya chapters, Arya and Sansa chapters are really good.
Sansa's growing on me. But even Arya's crazy, right? Like,
no, but Arya's so awesome. The stuff in the last book, the Arya chapters alone, that could have been like a really awesome little like novella. Now, admittedly, she's sort of, you know, responding to the world around her and is sort of having a kind of magical childhood adventure.
Yeah.
But just with more stabbing.
But Sansa's growing on me. I will actually give you that. Sansa's growing on me, and I'm waiting for her to kill Peter Baelish.
It's going to be fun. But yes, no, I think that the religion of the Lord of Light and how they've played this whole sort of conversion in very violent ways is fascinating. And seeing the death of sort of mediocre, getting along faiths. I mean, like the church, the main church in Westeros is starting to kind of crumble. And yes, what's rising up is a very starker, very, you know, like, we need to put swords back in the hand of the clergy.
Yeah.
You know, we need to have our own private army. You know, the same thing with the drowned gods. You know, like, they're having a revival, but it's a revival of blood and sacrifice. You know, the people winning converts are not the folks winning them with, you know, glasses of sherry and, like, theological discussions. It's all happening at the point of a sword or a torch.
But I mean, human nature, right? Yeah. I mean, there is something in us that responds to that kind of zeal.
So we've talked a lot about The Seven in George R. Martin, and we'll return to him later with one of his other books. But since we're talking about it, it really is closely compared to one of the faiths in the Chalion series by Bujold. It's either fivefold or fourfold, depending on
which possibly heretical sect you're part of. But it's a five god pantheon, and it's the mother, father, son, daughter, and the bastard.
Yeah, and it's similar to what we see in the George R. R. Martin series, where you have the warrior, the smith, the mother, and then the final one, the stranger.
Yes,
there's some interesting parallels, but Bujold,
which I think is, I mean, it's that, I mean, the these figures are classic, pantheistic.
Oh yeah. No. They're very archetypal. Right? They're sort of,
having this extra being that sort of catches the misfits and the marginalized, mm-hmm, and the others.
Yeah.
I think is, again, it shows their understanding of human nature.
Well, and Bujold does such a wonderful job of making this religion feel so natural and feel such a part of the
and
world.
And I think what she does is, what I love about the Chalion books is that she builds in a heresy. And I think that is something you don't often see when we play with religions.
No, it's really true.
Which is the break-off sect that sees the bastard not as a god, but as a demon.
Mm-hmm.
And so and Bujold gets ritual. So that each of the gods is associated with a particular part of the body. And much like Christians would cross themselves, the mark, the reverencing mark in this religion is to touch your forehead, your stomach,
your lips.
Oh, sorry, your
lips, your heart,
your stomach, and your groin. Or is the groin the bastard?
No. I think the groin is like the son or the daughter father. Or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's one of them.
And with the five fingers of your hand, and these heretics don't make only the 4-point. Gesture with just the 4 fingers of their hand.
Yeah.
And so when the heretics capture the
believers, there's a lot of thumb chopping.
Yeah, they chop off the thumbs so they can't actually make the sign of their faith. Which is the other comparison between Bujold and Martin, their ability to be terrible.
They both like chopping things.
They do like chopping things and like torturing their characters quite a lot.
And again, it's with the Bujold, I mean, the gods play very active roles. They are undeniable. And yet,
what I love is this idea of the saints in that series. The saints are these people who are being used by one of the gods for a particular purpose. And so they are, I mean, they are individuals with very clear links. I mean, they are very connected to the gods, but it's not a prize, it's a burden.
Yeah, they're
it's almost a curse.
Yeah, it's a huge sort of, and well, they're very human, you know, right? They, you know, they're not just these purely divine people, which very appropriate given that we've just we're in the era of all saints and all souls. And we were having this discussion in one of our church groups talking about, you know, what does it mean to be a saint? And, you know, when we go around saying, you know, are we all saints, or are saints these particularly sort of holy people who've had miracles attached to them? And, you know, it really it resonates.
And I think what resonates for me in that is to be a saint is a terrifying thing. To actually be touched by divinity is, I mean, it's a gift. But it is...
But it's scary.
It's scary.
Yeah, and it comes with huge costs and huge consequences, which they do a really good job of bouncing around and looking at. And again, I compare it a lot with I don't know, I feel like with so much fantasy, I don't know, it all feels sort of forced.
Well, I mean, the quintessential science fiction religion that people would point to is the Jedi faith, right? And even that, I mean, does not have quite this level of rich, complex, nuanced understanding of the religious impulse.
Well, and the vaguer it is, the better it is, right? Yeah. It's when folks try to nail it down and start coming up with specific things that you wind up with midichlorians.
Yes.
So I think that both series really do a fascinating job of playing with faith and how people interact with it and how they struggle. Mm-hmm. With it in very interesting ways, in very unique ways.
And how faith is a burden as much as a gift.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in our world, I think there's very often the impulse for people to say, faith makes things easier. Faith is a crutch, right? That's the Richard Dawkins attitude towards those of us who...
It's a crutch.
It makes life easier. It's something we fall back on. And I think, which is, again, to go back, I don't know, I have any reason to suspect that George R. R. Martin or Louis Master Bujold are themselves particularly religious people of any form. But they understand that religion does not make things easier.
Yeah.
In a way that's not just vilifying religion.
Yeah. No, I think that's very true.
That they understand that somehow religion is something that is important to human society.
Well, who was it who defined man as a creature that creates religion? That sounds like something G.K. Chesterton would have said. I'm sure Tom will let us know. I wanted to bounce back to Martin in one of his earlier books, which will be coming back into print next year. I'm very excited. And that's Tough Voyaging. T-U-F Voyaging. And it's much more of a sort of straightforward adventure story, but it constantly returns to notions of faith and notions of how there's a specific planet that the main character keeps interacting with, which have this sort of belief that they have to propagate the species in order to sort of to reach this kind of maximum critical evolutionary threshold before the heat death of the universe, and this gets them into difficulties.
Serious ecological trouble?
Well, there's the ecological troubles, but also with their neighbors, since, you know, they will be wanting to overpopulate into them. And it really goes back and forth and looking at, you know, it's a very straightforward science fiction story with a lot of sort of, you know, just science fiction elements, but they constantly clash with this faith and it's never 100% clear, you know, who is right and who is wrong in it. You know, like the morals get very sort of fuzzy. And I think it's a great early example of how Martin does look at how faith interacts with people's lives. And then with Bujold's other big series, the Vorkosigan Saga, faith plays a very subtle part. We see a lot of tradition in the Vorkosigan saga. For those who don't know, the general idea is mankind went out into space via wormholes, and one particular planet got shut down. Their wormhole shut down, so they're isolated from the rest of the human race, and they devolve and kind of begin reforming society until they hit kind of 19th century Russian or Prussian, and then they reconnect, and suddenly, you know, you've essentially got princesses and princes with lasers, which is a lot
it's
of fun.
It's the best.
Because, you know, you can have a fancy ball or a fancy dinner party and then, you know, go shooting people with your space guns. But it deals a lot with, you know, how does a group of people who have very traditional understandings of their world and of their relationship with it deal with a much larger universe. And, you know, you see superstitions, you see people constantly sort of, you know, signing themselves or warding off, you know, sort of curses with evil eyes and things like that. But you also see in the characters, you know, how their faith interacts with technology and how their sort of consciences come up and clash with, you know, basic sort of progress. You know, she provides a kind of completely amoral planet that sort of free market capitalism gone rampant, sort of Dubai, Hong Kong times 1,000. You have what's essentially
Jackson's Hole.
You then have Beta Colony, which is sort of Space Canada. And Bariar, which is Prussian Germany under Bismarck with plasma guns. But they all deal with a certain amount of faith and a certain amount of an interaction with a world outside of just...
No, I'm interested to hear where you're sort of going with this, because I don't actually see religion playing that much of an explicit role.
It's not explicit.
Vorkosigan saga.
No, it's not explicit at all. It's touched on just here and there. I mean, I suppose the book that deals the most with it is Ethan of Athos.
Oh, okay.
Ethan of Athos, which presents...
That was before I started liking the series again.
Oh, I see. Ethan of Athos is a fascinating read because it's a standalone. So if you're not interested in reading, you know, 18 books, I would definitely recommend trying to find it. The idea is a group of men have developed a perfectly male society. It is, there are no women.
It's coming back.
They do all their reproducing via sort of kind of cloning technology, mm-hmm. and they have access to various eggs that they've been sort of, you know, constantly replicating, and they're, you know, they're running into a bit of a gene crisis, and one of them has to go out and deal with it. But Ethan of Athos is fascinating because it's a fish out of water story, because you have this man who has to leave his planet in order to find more eggs, and he's suddenly having to, you know, come deal with women who have explained to him are vile, evil, you know, temptresses who destroy men's will, and is having to realize, oh, maybe they're not so bad after all, and it's so bizarre and strange and yet very earnest. You know, it's not really a joke. And Bujold shows a lot of sensitivity and walks a very interesting line, which shows, I don't know, it's a maturity with how you look at issues of believing in, you know, the things that are not objectively sort of, you know, provable or visible. And various characters sort of will profess to have a kind of faith that touches upon their conscience or what decisions they make. And it can have a dramatic impact on the world, and so it's very interesting to see. And you have folks as well who obviously have terrible faiths, which let them do pretty odious things. I think that's a pretty standard part of all both Bujold and Martin books.
Yeah, and I think what else is interesting is we've talked so far about like religion in society, right? The larger role that religion plays on a sort of macro level. But I think what both of these writers give us is different individuals and how different individuals treat their faith as well and the impact it has on specific people. So, I mean, I think in Game of Thrones, for instance, we have Ned Stark, who is the sort of quintessential representative for the old gods.
Yeah, with his sort of stoic... family first kind of ways. Yes.
But he's very devout.
Yeah.
I mean, spends his time praying in the God's Wood, and you see the way that faith has shaped yeah, everything about him.
And his sense of obligation and his sense of honor, which is such a huge part of what he does.
And again, and I think just to problematize it a little bit, we do see how that the honor that defines him is what leads to his downfall, because it doesn't prepare him to deal with a more complicated world.
Yeah. No, that's very true. And for me, I think a character whose faith is very subtly played with is Davos. Because he's a man who's...
Oh, you want to talk about Davos?
I do want to talk about Davos because he's one of the best characters in the entire series.
One of the best?
Okay, the best.
Go on.
Davos is surrounded by the hyper-religious, sort of, you know, religious... you know, he's at the sort of ground zero of this new Valor religion. But he holds just this sort of simple peasant faith. You know, we see him being very superstitious. He's always sort of touching his little bag of knuckles for good luck. But the faith he has is...
I mean, is that faith in Stannis?
Well, he has his faith in Stannis, which is a huge thing. But we see him sort of constantly talking about the Seven, talking about, like, you know, his sons, and being sort of saddened when he sees his, you know, one of his sons leave, you know, the faith and sort of turn from it. And, you know, the whole burning of the different gods sort of touches on him. And again, it's not this sort of overt, oh my gods, what will I do?
But he is a simple man, and the gods have been there for him.
Precisely.
I mean, well, the gods have been there for him, and the gods haven't been there for him. The gods have given him sons, and the gods have taken his sons.
Yeah.
But through that all, he remains
tied to
faithful.
It. Yeah. And that's really where there's a sort of a simple beauty to it. And he certainly sees what horrors can come from the new faiths. But it's what
and
I find
compelling.
And there is
a piety in him which is different than Ned Stark's piety. I mean, Ned would see him as...
A pirate.
A smuggler. But he is a faithful man.
Yeah.
Well, and then, you know, in Bujold, in the Chalion series, I mean, I think the two central characters to talk about there are Kaz and whoever the woman's name is in Paladin of Souls.
It's been too long since I read that one. The lady. Very nice lady.
Very, very nice lady.
Well, and what's so great about them is that, and again, this is Bujold's great strength, is she presents you with these characters that in a lot of other books could just sort of, they could be anything. They could be 20-year-olds, they could be 40-year-olds, it doesn't really matter.
But she presents you with characters that have a history, who are damaged in some way, and what, this might be beating a drum again, but, you know, the main character in Paladin of Souls, whose name we both seem to have forgotten, is an older woman. She's a matron who is still allowed to be a protagonist, to be a central character.
Valinda? Does that sound right?
That doesn't sound right.
It says Valinda. Maybe that's her hometown.
I think that's her... Yeah, that's where she's from. She's the Countess of Valinda.
It won't give me a name.
I feel like it starts with an I.
I got nothing.
Okay.
I got nothing here. The Queen. Anyway, doesn't matter. She is a very nice lady.
But these are both characters. She is someone who was touched by the gods. And the only way she could deal with the way the gods broke into her life was basically feigning insanity.
Yeah.
For years.
Yeah.
And again, you see that burden of religious faith and burden of...
They're not used
by the gods.
Yeah, precisely. It's there's an old series by a missionary that we actually my folks knew in Nigeria, Robert Don Baker, I think. Wait, was that a televangelist? I think his guy's name was Robert Don Baker. Anyway, but he wrote a very fascinating series of just a fantasy trilogy with The Power and the Prophet, The Prophet of Lameth, I think, and maybe that talking castle or something strange like that. And it was very unsubtly looking at a, you know, sort of benevolent monotheistic being. But there was this whole idea that there was this prophet who channeled this power, and that was all the religion was known as, was the power, this force. And it was like this burden. It was this thing that pressed upon him that was benevolent, but at the same time sort of all-consuming. And sort of pushing him in these different directions, and you got that sort of Old Testament sense, you know, of being given a task and a burden you don't want, and yet seeing it through to its inevitable conclusion, you know, which generally is for the betterment of the world. And it's a very powerful thing to see, and I appreciate when fiction plays with these notions of power and responsibility.
Because it doesn't trivialize religion. And yeah. I think that's what I appreciate most about Martin and Bujold both, is they do not trivialize
it. They don't trivialize it. They don't tack it on.
Yeah.
And they don't make it
and
so...
And they aren't just condemning it.
Yeah, they're not just right? condemning it or just sort of making it this sort of overt thing that, you know, you just kind of roll your eyes at. Or again, you know, Dungeons and Dragoning it, where it's just so mechanized and...
And understanding it as an important part of human society without making it just a sociological construct, right? There yeah. is a reality behind these faiths mm-hmm. as well. I mean, and
people respond to it in both good and bad
yeah,
ways.
Exactly.
Which and it's in that conflict that we see things being very very interesting. Again, that heresy, which is a beautiful, very simple heresy,
leads to so much violence and thumb chopping off.
Yeah. So I think that's about all I got on those two masters. If you have not read those books, then I hope you didn't pay too much attention to what we said, because there are a lot of spoilers.
But especially you need to read the Vorkosigan
Saga. Oh, Vorkosigan Saga is so good. I like more of them than Rachel does.
Well, I don't really care for the central character.
In most of the books?
No, not most of the books. Just the ones between the ages of, like, 4 and 29.
Anyway, they're good books, so read them.
So... Geek news.
So the big news this week, we've touched on two sides of it already. When we discussed Newsies, we had the Disney component, and we discussed the Jedi.
Can you talk about this as geek news? Like,
yes, this is the biggest geek news. This is the royal wedding of geek news. I would be remiss not to talk about it.
I see.
Of course, we are talking about the Disney Star Wars coming together, which. Will lead to who knows what kind of madness and money shoveling into the various maws of these two different enterprises.
Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think because George R. R. Martin donated this for... George R. R. Martin. George Lucas donated this $4 billion to schools that we are now no longer allowed to hate Jar Jar Binks?
It's a question of what these schools do. If these schools try to create some sort of revisionist history where, like, you know, Indiana Jones... actually deals with crystal skulls and midichlorians actually exist, then I think we would be well within our rights to you know, attack them with all of our fire and axes.
I'm not talking about attacking the schools. I'm just asking if I'm still allowed to hate Jar Jar Binks.
Yes.
Because I don't know if I want to live in a world where I'm not allowed to hate Jar Jar Binks.
You know, we can appreciate that, you know, Carnegie gave a lot of money to different schools while at the same time being a sort of odious robber baron. I think that's the way to look at it.
Okay.
George Lucas has entered the Gilded Age. Now, it's another little tack on. I wanted to do a shout out. We've been talking about religion in different sort of settings. I've been dumping on Dungeons and Dragons. And that's largely because there are so many ways in gaming to deal with religion. And I want to shout out and pimp my friend Tom Kolar's wonderful series he did on RPG.net called Clerical Error. It was a wonderful series of about 15 different articles looking at how you deal with religion in any kind of game. Now, you could take this outside of gaming to also any sort of fiction writing as well, because it's essentially this looking at how to make a religion more than just, you know, oh, I guess my world should have religion. I suppose they worship trees? Question mark. And how you actually make it come alive in your world. And it's a wonderful, wonderful series. So if you have a chance to check them out, I would recommend doing that.
I, for my part, feel somewhat obliged to mention the Rachel Held Evans book, A Year of Biblical Womanhood, just because it is making the waves around Christian circles these days. It strikes me, having now read it, it strikes me as sort of 2012's equivalent to the Rob Bell book that came out a little while ago. Mm. Like, it's making big waves in the conservative evangelical circles,
okay.
And I don't think anything in it is even the remotest bit earth-shattering to anyone...
Who's actually been following these things?
Like, not in that world.
Yeah.
No, which is not to... I do not say that to denigrate the book. I think it's... I mean, it's... She's a great writer, and so, I mean, she manages to make... her journey very compelling.
Now, she's essentially cosplaying as Ruth, right?
Basically. Okay. Well, except that Ruth was a Gentile. Ruth was a Gentile. So she's trying to be a faithful, like, as biblically faithful as possible. So she's kind of not cosplaying as Ruth.
Oh, I see. So cosplaying as Martha? I'm trying to think of good biblical female role models. I guess they don't ever get names.
I guess you're very... Yeah, well, I think your very inability to figure out what the ideal role model she would be cosplaying as is kind of the point of her book.
Who's the tent peg girl?
Jail.
There we go.
All right. No, but I mean, the whole point that she's getting at is that there is no one simple standard for biblical womanhood, and that women are, hey, you know, people and have messy lives. And
sometimes you got to tent peg a dude.
Sometimes I guess you got to tent peg a dude. And I mean, I found some of her insights very interesting, you know, because she was willing to say, oh, you know, like her chapter on silence was very powerful, because she makes the comment that silence, when it is used to oppress women, is a very terrible thing. When women are told they must be silent and have no voice, at the same time, silence can be very empowering for all of us when we impose it on ourselves and are silent before God. And she uses this as a way to explore contemplative prayer and the discipline of silence. So I actually thought it was a fairly nuanced book and an interesting look at how we understand scripture. And I think that for those of us who are maybe in the more liberal side of Christianity, who aren't necessarily in the world that she's directly addressing in the book, so we're not in a context where women are told we have to stay in the home and we can't have any...
You're not wearing that Proverbs t-shirt.
No. You know, and I am a female priest, obviously. I'm not someone who feels I must be confined to the domestic sphere. But I think those of us who are on the more liberal side of the church could have something... could take something away from the book as well, because...
Well, she treats religion seriously. Because
she's, yeah, and it goes back, you know, she treats religion seriously, she's treating the Bible seriously, and I think what she's trying to show is how we do the Bible a disservice when we take it too literally. At the same time, there's much there to be applied to our lives, and much there that should shape us and challenge us and change us. So on the whole, I would give it a big thumbs up, but I don't think that any of the supposedly controversial material in it is going to be anything that earth-shattering for someone who is not living in a conservative evangelical subculture.
But still a good read.
So I guess that sums it up for us this week. As always, we want to thank our friends Debs and Earl for the use of their Geek Love Song as our theme music.
That's right. So go out there, folks. Have a wonderful geek week. And we will try to be back before too long, perhaps this time even, with a guest.
And on that, we wish you a wonderful week in the world of faith, fandom, and family.
And no particular order.
Wana Ryana Roaisha in Vulcan and Klingon, it's Kafaha, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset.
Nikar Telegar Tharastam is Mandalorian, in and out of galaxy long gone by. If you speak Hatties, you say Umajimuna on Dagobah.
Love you, do I.